Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. Today we have Theodore Dalrymple. He is undoubtedly well known to many of our readers. He did a strong piece for us in the letter series that Rusty Reno crafted. He wrote Letter to an Aspiring Doctor that came out in December 2018. He has a review of us for us in the last issue on a book on architecture, maybe the abominations of architecture that we see so often. He is a frequent contributor to City Journal, The New Criterion. That was where I first came across his writings in The New Criterion, and National Review, New English Review, and many other top periodicals. He is the author of many books, much of his writing coming out of his work as a doctor and psychiatrist caring over his lifetime for the poor, for criminals, addicts, and other members of the underclass. His books include Spoiled Rotten, The Toxic Cult of Sentimentality, that was 2010, Our Culture, What's Left of It, The Mandarins and the Masses, that's 2005, and a book that actually was important to me a few years earlier called Life at the Bottom, The Worldview That Makes the Underclass, a book that I read back then and that helped me to adjust some of my social opinions away from, maybe we'll call it liberal sentimentality or liberal apologetics. Today's topic is another book. It's entitled The Terror of Existence, From Ecclesiastes to Theater of the Absurd. It has recently come out. It's published by New English Review Press, and it has an interesting format. And rather than try to describe it myself, let me ask you, Dr. Dalrymple, first of all, welcome. Thank you for joining us, and give us the overview of the book.
Well, first of all, thank you for asking me. The book is not exactly a conversation, but short essays by me and an Irish journalist and teacher called Ken Francis. And it's about literature that asks questions such as what is life for? What is the good life? Perennial questions, as seen through various texts that we write about. We don't always write about the same texts. In fact, I think we only write about three of the texts that are the same, but books like The Stranger by Camus and various others, which, in our opinion, raise very acutely the question of what life is for. And we come from a slightly different perspective. He's a strong Catholic. I'm actually not religious at all. But the fact is that we do see similar problems and questions for mankind, which are not answered definitively.
Let me ask, did you grow up in a religious household? Did you grow up religious yourself?
No, I didn't.
And your experience working with a lot of people who seem bereft of any larger, let's just say larger metaphysical structure of life, that hasn't changed your religious opinions?
No, but in a way it has, in the sense that I'm, unlike many people who are not religious, I'm not hostile to religion, and I certainly wouldn't want to convince anybody who was religious of my particular point of view, unless, of course, they were trying to force themselves upon me. But that really isn't the situation as I've lived it. And therefore, I'm very tolerant of religion, because I think it provides people with answers that they find satisfactory. And the fact is that in present circumstances anyway, I think that mankind requires a transcendent purpose. And it's not easy for people to find a transcendent purpose. There can be a religious transcendent purpose. There can be other transcendent purposes, such as cultural activity or a deep political belief, that these don't hold for most people. They don't have such cultural activities or deep religious beliefs, And they don't even have a struggle for survival. I mean, it's almost impossible not to survive in modern society. So there's a big gaping hole, really, in their lives, which they fill in various ways, often, in my view, very self-destructively, and often destructively to people around them.
I should say to our viewers that they should look you up. They should read your writings, because you are one of the preeminent observers or witnesses of that intellectually important group, the underclass. The underclass, which has been understood by liberal and progressive thinkers in one way, and you, in your immediate experience of these peoples working in prisons, seeing patients frequently, for instance, women who battered wives, and spending time with them, talking with them, getting to know them, and seeing how what their mindset is, what their worldview is, and how they understand the things that happen to them, has provided a very powerful, again, counter witness based upon your concrete professional and personal work with these people over many years' time, and it has been documented by you deeply in your books, and it gives you, I think, a strong authority to talk about people searching for a transcendent purpose, or not searching one, maybe not even realizing that they have one. You know, a hidden one, you know, Marxists, for instance, having their transcendent purpose that they wouldn't understand really in those terms. But it's something that, as you went through your professional career working with these people, did the experience surprise you? Did your direct exposure to, say, the criminal mind, the criminal pathology, astonish you?
Yes, I think it did, really. I mean, I hadn't given the question much thought. Incidentally, before I start, I would like to say that I'm not entirely happy with the term underclass, because it implies that there's a group of people, whatever percentage of the population it is, 5 or 10%, who are very distinct from the rest of the population, and easily recognizable as different. And that's not my view. My view is that I was dealing with people at the lower end of a spectrum, it is true, but actually their cultural influence on the social classes higher than themselves was actually very strong. And you can see this in fashion and things like tattooing, for example.
Right, right. I think I've seen you quote one of the ancient writers talking about how when the upper classes start imitating the behaviors of the lower classes, then we're in big trouble.
Yes. Well, I think whether or not that is true, that we're in big trouble, it certainly happened.
Yes. So, and you know, I don't know where the term underclass came from. Was that social scientists writing in the mid 20th century, or I don't know the origin of the term.
Well, I mean, Marx uses the term lumpen proletariat, which I think is probably a very similar term to the underclass. But as I said, I don't actually like it, because I think it implies that there is a categorical difference when actually it's a dimensional difference. So having said that, however, I was actually almost shocked, I would say, by the propensity to self-destruct of enormous numbers of people. And I'm not talking, it's true that my sample is a selected one, but it's not a small one. You know, and I heard about the lives of perhaps, I've worked it out, maybe in my time of 50,000 people.
Right, right.
So this is more than just an anecdote. And I was shocked. I'd traveled extensively in civil wars and seen, I had this slight taste for danger when I was young, political danger. So I liked traveling to bad places. And And of course, I saw terrible things, and people had experienced the most awful things, actually. But what really surprised me was the way in which people, when they had a choice, when there was nothing to force them to behave extremely badly and self-destructively, nevertheless chose to do so. And that did surprise me. I hadn't realized that. And if I hadn't done the work I did, I would never have known it.
Well, one of the things you mentioned in the book is that you would sometimes listen to patients talk about being poor, needing more money, and you would ask them, what would you do if you got a bunch of money, if you became suddenly rich? And they didn't really have an answer to that question.
No, I mean, the answer would be that they would consume more.
More. Just more.
Just more. But actually what it was that they would consume more of, I suppose they'd live in a bigger house and they'd have a fancier car and so on and so forth. But essentially, the life wouldn't be very different from the one that they were living now, then, and would consist probably of self-destructive consumption. And one sees that with people who suddenly do come in to a lot of money without any transcendent purpose in their life or any cultural activity and so on.
Okay. So let's get to the book. Let me just run through the works that you discuss with Mr. Francis. We have Ecclesiastes, Gulliver's Travels, Poe's Story of the Telltale Heart, Camus' The Stranger, Sartre's Nausea, La Nausée, Chekhov, Waiting for Godot, The Catcher in the Rye, that perennial high school favorite here, and more. We have Shakespeare's Hamlet, Nietzsche on the Madman, and others. The Tolstoy. I thought the Tolstoy on the Death of Ivan Ilyich that you did was a powerful section. There are others in there, but that gives our audiences a flavor of the works that you discuss. But let me ask first about the title. What do you mean by the terror of existence?
Well, this is. I can't remember whose title it was. I think it was Ken's, so you'd be better off asking him what he meant by it. But I suppose it means the question, what do we do now when our existence is assured, at least for 70 or 80 years or whatever our life expectancy is now? We live in times of unprecedented safety and comfort, actually. You have only to think of my father's life expectancy when he was born. It was 47. So this is something that is quite unprecedented in human history. And we are now faced with this problem. What do we do once our basic needs are more or less the satisfaction of our basic needs is more or less guaranteed. And we can be faced with a kind of terror. I used to see it with my patients a question, it doesn't sound a very terrifying question, but it did terrify quite a lot of them. And that was, what are you interested in?
What are you interested in?
What are you interested in? And it caught them up. They hadn't really thought about it, of course, before. And they were reduced to silence for a time, and you could see them searching in their minds. And finally, they came up with shopping.
Shopping. Well, there's variety there. There is satisfaction, at least momentary satisfaction. I guess it's a way of, I mean, the marketers certainly make you feel that it's a mode of personal expression, but...
It is rather shallow.
Indeed.
I would define shopping really as the insolvent in search of the unnecessary, but in pursuit of the unnecessary. But anyway, I think that gives you the flavor of the kind of terror that we're talking about. We're not talking about the knock on the door at midnight and being carted off to some terrible prison camp. That's not it.
Right. And we can be so, we have so much prosperity. We have such a profusion of consumer goods. You know, I had a student from Korea who came, and she had grown up in a rough time over in Korea, and she said that when she first got to America and went through a grocery store, she said she spent an hour, and it was just miraculous. She would walk up and down again. This cornucopia of so much. It was just so much on all the colors and everything. And she was amazed by what she was seeing. Of course, now she walks through the grocery store and thinks nothing of it, right?
That's yes.
We become newer to this.
Actually, that great profusion can cause anxiety because when you are buying something, you are beginning to wonder whether you are choosing the right thing. And I've lived some of my life in places where you ate more or less what there was. You didn't choose, or your choice was extremely limited. And I can tell you from my experience, though I like good food and so on, that actually the difference in the enjoyment of your life is almost nil. And in some ways is better when you don't have so much choice.
I was in the Nike store with my son a couple of weeks ago, and all these kids were in there. They're trying on different shoes. They're trying to make a decision. They're looking at them. And I finally said to my 13-year-old son, you know, when I was your age, there were about three tennis shoes that you could choose from, and everything was simple. Here, I mean, the pressure that this consumerism puts on what you just said. Am I choosing the right thing? You're raising this decision for 12-year-olds to such critical.
Well, I mean, there are two things to say about this. The first is that all those shoes are exactly the same anyway, fundamentally the same. So actually what it arouses is what Freud, I'm not a great fan of Freud, but it's a very good phrase, the narcissism of small differences.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And these can become extremely important, thus trivializing people's minds. And I've even had, I've had one case where of murder over mockery over someone's shoes, which to me would be indistinguishable from the shoes that everyone else was wearing. And Again, I'm not. I can't claim myself to be anti-materialist in the sense that I'm. I don't subsist on locusts and honey myself.
Now, let's get into the book. We have several interesting observations that you make in the book. I wanted to bring up a few of them. One of them is you write about Jonathan Swift, Gulliver's Travels. And when people talk about, you know, reading literature will make you a better person, I say, do you really think reading book four of Gulliver's Travels is going to make you like people more than you did before? And you actually have an interesting beginning there where you say that Swift's misanthropy was very clearly a result of him wanting very deeply to love humanity.
Well, if he hadn't wanted that, he wouldn't really have gone to the trouble of denouncing it so much. I mean, if you don't care, you don't denounce. And when he says, I cannot but conclude that your countrymen are the most odious race of pernicious little vermin that ever crawled upon the surface of the earth, which is, I don't think there's ever been a clearer condemnation of humanity than that.
That's right. That's right. I mean, Gulliver ends up back in England. He's lived among the Houyhnhnms, those rational horses. A lot of people who use Yahoo on the computer don't realize what the Yahoos were in Swift, but he's there. He can't stand the smell of human beings. He's got to put flowers, nosegays around his nose to avoid the smell of him. And he prefers to be there in the stables talking to the horses. He can't stand the company of his own wife. even. And, you know, of course, he's off because of his experiences, but Swift is enjoying very much, I think, this. But as you say, it's an inverse of a desire to love humanity. You put it this way. Bitterness of Swift's degree is the consequence of disillusionment that is never quite complete. For if it were complete, the imperfections of the world would simply be accepted. It is therefore not resignation or a settled indifference to humanity that Swift exhibits. It is rather a mirror image of love, a love that has fermented, as it were, and gone sour. One might surmise that Swift despised humanity so much because he would like to have loved it so much. After all, no one criticizes anything with such burning and obviously sincere ferocity as did Swift criticize humanity without caring deeply about it. I think that's a wonderful description of Gulliver's Travels, and I've never quite understood things that way. I can't remember critics writing about that. Perhaps it takes a psychiatrist to see underneath Swift's bitterness and again the ferocity of his denunciation, the desire to love.
Well, to me, it seems a fairly obvious thing, really, actually, when you come to think of it. And, you know, his savage indignation. You're not indignant about, shall we say, about the moon or things that you just accept as being there. And, of course, he was a difficult man, of course, and he had, don't forget that from a very early age, I forgot what age it was, he started to go deaf and he had severe dizziness, which probably doesn't do much for your temper, and so on. And he had disappointments in life and so on. But I think that it seems obvious to me that someone who is so bitter must have expected a great deal.
Another fantasy work that you cite in the course of the book, apart from Gulliver's Travels, is actually a long quotation that you have in the discussion of Waiting for Godot from Marx and Engels' The German Ideology, which you actually treat as fantasy. It's when they write, in communist society, where nobody has one exclusive sphere of activity, but each can become accomplished in any branch he wishes, society regulates the general production and thus makes it possible for me to do one thing today and another tomorrow, to hunt in the morning, fish in the afternoon, rear cattle in the evening, criticize after dinner, just as I have a mind, without ever becoming a hunter, fisherman, herdsman, or critic. That's Marx's vision of the proper society. And your comment is very simple. That anyone past the age of adolescence could have given a moment's assent to this drivel or to the persons capable of producing it is a tribute to human credulity. How in the world did anyone take this kind of vision of human possibility seriously?
Well, firstly, in Marx and Engels' defense, which is a position I don't often find myself in, they didn't publish this. It was found after, it was posthumously published, I think. However, if you read The Soul of Man Under Socialism by Oscar Wilde, you find practically exactly the same sentiment. And Oscar Wilde, of course, was a very brilliant man. But this is the kind of dream that I'm afraid I think is quite widespread. That there are artists within us all, that we are all capable of everything, and that the only thing that is preventing us is the division of labor and the wickedness of the way in which society is organized and so on and forth, which is stifling our natural productivity and our natural goodness. And only when everything is changed will the full beauty of the human personality emerge. And that actually was the was the view of people, I think the radicals in the 1960s who wanted, for example, to break down families and so on, because families are constraining, unhappy marriages are extremely unhappy. There's no question of that. And that there is some way of organizing things in which all these frustrations and unhappinesses will go away. Now, if you compare that with, say, Rasselas of Dr. Johnson's Rasselas, which is a wonderful, although very dense, little fable.
Love that book.
It's a wonderful book. And what he's saying in that book is dissatisfaction is the permanent condition of mankind, and all the things that mankind wants are not compatible one with another, and therefore there will always be dissatisfaction. There's no such thing as perfect life on earth.
And when thinkers come along and say it need not be this way, and offer, say, the Marxist utopian, you know, the workers' paradise, a whole lot of people join in. Who wants to live with the terror of existence, right? And does that make Marxism count as Whitaker Chambers believed it was, or communism? Does that make communism count as a religion?
I think it is. Well, certainly it's very. It has a lot in common with religion, and I know, for example, people are still communists in France, and it's clear that it's to them it's religion and no evidence. For example, it's religion transposed from a transcendent kind of belief to one that's an earthly belief. But it's perfectly clear that they don't consider any empirical evidence, and they hold on to their belief very strongly. So in that sense, it is. But it's a very harmful religion, of course. And I find it rather difficult to believe. I think anybody who offers an overall solution to all human problems is a dangerous person.
These are dangerous people. Whitaker Chambers, though, he believed that the communists would win, because they had the religious impulse that the West was losing. And religions tend to beat non-religions. Is that true in the course of history?
Yes, although one can't say that because it was so in the past will be so in the future. I think that would be a mistake. But certainly strong belief is very important in any conflict. And we do have a kind of sentimental view that if people are willing to go to extremes to further their belief, there must be some element of truth or goodness in that belief, which is certainly not true.
They're full of passionate intensity. And how can we criticize that?
Well, and we are not, of course. We are. We don't have any passionate beliefs, at least none so passionate that they can resist this kind of monomania, actually. And I did think that with the downfall of the Soviet Union, there would be an end to these passionate beliefs. But on the contrary, we've seen a balkanization of them. Yeah, we are back. I mean, they're smaller. People have their identity politics. They have a kind of limited utopia for their identity, as it were. But they are full of passionate intensity.
And they have their enemies, too.
Oh, yes. Well, they need enemies. I mean, there wouldn't be any point to it if there were no enemies. So I was mistaken in thinking that ideology as such would die with the Soviet Union.
You have a powerful chapter on Philip Larkin, his poem Obad. Larkin may be the one who is the most blunt about the terror of existence and non-existence, especially in this poem that you read. I'm going to read a few lines that you quote. Where and when I shall myself die. This mode of thought, as he well knows, is futile, arid interrogation, yet the dread of dying and of being dead flashes afresh to hold and horrify. That's one quote. Read another quote. The mind blanks at the glare, not in remorse, but at the total emptiness forever, the sure extinction that we travel and shall be lost in always, not to be here, not to be anywhere, and soon, nothing more terrible, nothing more true. Is there anything in Larkin, any place in his poetry where he offered some relief from the dread of death and annihilation?
Well, again, he must have felt that there was some purpose in what he was doing, otherwise he wouldn't have done it. And oddly enough, the poem Ubad, though it is, as you rightly say, pretty dismal, nevertheless, it doesn't depress. Well, it doesn't depress me. I don't know whether it depressed you. But it doesn't depress. On the contrary, this is a peculiar thing. It reconciles you to the situation, as Rasselas reconciles you to the fact that there is no fully satisfactory mode of life. Once you know there is no satisfactory mode of life, you don't seek a wholly satisfactory mode of life, and therefore you can begin to enjoy what you actually have, rather than pine after what you don't have and can't have. So I don't think it, although it is as bleak a poem, and he is as bleak a poet as it's possible really to conceive, nevertheless, it doesn't actually make you depressed, it doesn't make you want to go and kill yourself. I personally find facile optimism much more depressing.
This is why, one reason why you like the first entry, Ecclesiastes, which you call an antidote or corrective to pride. And that's one of the things that saves it, as you say, from being a depressing kind of read.
Yes. I suppose it helps you to understand that you're not really all that important.
You know, there's a relief that comes. I'm not the center of the universe. Everything doesn't depend on me.
Yes. I do sometimes go down the high street and think, if I were to die tomorrow, this butcher's shop would still be open and people would still be coming in to buy their sausages or whatever it is that they buy. And it's not entirely a depressing thought, although I think I quote the King Departs by Ionesco. I think Ionesco is a very, very good playwright, much better than Beckett, in which Le Roi Béranger, I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous, but he hasn't considered that he's going to die, and eventually they tell him he's going to die, and he
me
yes, me, and then when he accepts that he's going to die, says in a wonderful speech, I mean, it's hilarious, let everything be called after me, after my death, let everybody be called Béranger, let all books be about me, and so on and so forth.
He carries a very heavy burden.
Yes, and he wants everything to be about him, and in that sense to be immortal. In fact, Ionesco did have a fear of death. From very early on in his life. But again, this is not depressing, it's amusing, and it helps you to realize that actually you're not that important.
That'll do it for us for this book, The Terror of Existence, from Ecclesiastes to Theater of the Absurd. You can get it from New English Review Press.
Thank you very much.